Okay, folks, you are listening to the latest chapter, the latest edition, the latest adventure, I think is the word I was looking for, from Life on Planet Porky, with, of course, myself, the Porkmeister, and the rock chick writer extraordinaire, Ms. Leslie Ann Jones, who's with me now. Leslie Ann, a fine good day to you.
Thank you very much, Michael, and the same to you. Looks like the sun is shining on us today.
Sun is up. The sky is blue, it's beautiful, and so are you, dear Prudence. Except you're not Prudence, obviously.
Well, no, but great song. We know who that was written about, don't we?
It was the sister of the wife of Frank Sinatra, who went balmy in India. Is that right?
Sort of, yeah, a bit of a roundabout way of saying it. But yes, Mia Farrow's sister.
Yes, who used to be married to Frank Sinatra. And she retired into a hut at the Hashram, didn't she? If the, the guru. And she got depressed because she overdosed on drugs. And John Lennon apparently made that song up to sound like a nursery rhyme to make her feel safe and back to childhood, I was told.
Yeah, I think it was less to do with drugs, more to do with, you know, they were on a mission when they were in the ashram, weren't they? This is the Beatles, of course, to transcendental enlightenment. And Prudence was kind of racing the others to become enlightened ahead of everybody else. Yeah. So she was spending much more time meditating than the others and stayed in her little hut, as you rightly say. And they wrote this song to try and entice her out.
And did she come out in the end?
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe she's still in there.
Yeah, maybe she is. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Still looking for us, still waiting for us to come out. Talking about
this enlightenment business.
Yeah, exactly. Very enlightened indeed. Talking about that, and of course, our millions of listeners would be very upset if we didn't have at least one John Lennon story in every podcast. But just coincidentally, as we're recording now, flicking through my journals last night, I see that on this day in whatever year it was, John Lennon inserted the word Ono into his name. So he was John Winston Lennon, wasn't he, as christened by his parents. And he never liked the Winston, apparently, and he inserted Ono.
Well, his mother, Julia, gave him the middle name Winston as, just a normal middle name. I don't actually have a middle name, do you?
Yes, I'm Michael Allen Parry.
There you go. So that's what the Winston was. It wasn't a part of his surname. Yeah. But interestingly, when he adopted Ono, which was his wife's surname, that sort of became a double-barreled surname, but without the hyphen.
Yes,
so it wasn't really comparable to the Winston part.
Yeah. He did in reverse what lots of women have done over the generations. Like, for instance, Hillary Rodham Clinton. Okay, so she married Bill Clinton. She said, "All right, I will take your name, Clinton, but I'm not leaving mine," which was Rodham. So she became Hillary Rodham Clinton, and that was her official name.
That was a trend for quite a long time, wasn't it? And when my kids were little, at the schools they went to, people did seem to favour double-barreled surnames.
Yes,
and always a bit of a mouthful for the kids, I thought.
Yeah,
you know, to have to get their head around one name and to learn how to spell that is difficult enough without giving them two surnames to contend with.
No, I totally agree. In fact, I was born Michael Allen Newton Parry, Newton Parry being hyphenated. But I dropped the Newton bit from a very early age because, like you say, I thought it sounded stupid. Years ago, if you had a double-barreled surname, it was a kind of indication of the fact that you were from the landed gentry. Or posh or something like that. And then all of a sudden, footballers started coming out all over the place with double-barreled surnames, Wright Phillips and that kind of stuff.
In the Spanish culture, of course, you take both surnames of your mother and your father. So people do tend to shorten them for everyday use. But if you look at the real names of Spanish people, the name will always incorporate both surnames of mother and father.
Oh, really? Yeah, I didn't know that. Well, there you go. You learn something every day when you are talking to the rock chick writer extraordinaire. It's a culture vulture thing. Now, Ms. Jones, there has been massive interest worldwide on the big issue of the week, and that is that I, in fact, have had my hair cut. How about that?
Well, I thought you looked pretty good in the photos, actually.
Very good of you. Thank you very much indeed.
How was the experience? What was it like going back into a salon and having your hair washed and sort of trimmed up by some, scissor wielder?
I never have it washed like that. I mean, I have it wetted to be cut and all that. But whenever I go to have a haircut, I come out of the hairdressers, I go straight home and I go straight into the shower. I cannot understand anybody. It may be different for women, but I can't understand any bloke who, for instance, has once said to me, oh, at lunchtime, oh, I'm just going to go off and get my hair cut. I couldn't bear the thought of walking around for the rest of the day with all sorts of hair dust, you know, on my shirt collar and in my ears and on the front of my shirt. I don't know how any respectable person can do that.
You've obviously got very sensitive skin. My son was like this when he was little. Right. And we would take him off to get his hair cut. It was a major, major deal. I practically had to drag him there. We had to take a change of clothes because he was so sensitive to the little bits of hair that you describe.
Yeah.
So he would have to change his clothes immediately after the haircut. Then we'd have to go home. Then he'd have to have a bath. And then he'd have to change the clothes again.
Yeah.
So it was always, I never looked forward to it, I have to say.
Yeah, but don't you think it's also a bit messy to go into a hairdresser's, have you, and then go back to work with it all over your, you know, it's not so much on your skin, it's on the shoulders of your jacket and all that kind of stuff. Don't you think that's awful?
I think some people don't care, you know, but I think if you're hypersensitive, as you obviously are,
yeah,
that would bother you. So it makes sense to go home and wash it all off.
Yeah, sure. Anyway, the point of getting it done was because I did a bit of TV this week, and I did it on a TV panel, although we're in separate studios, with a chap called James McVeigh. And James McVeigh is the lead singer and guitarist for a group called The Vamps. And of course, I didn't know an awful lot about James until, you know, I had looked him up the night before to find out what he was all about. But he's had a couple of number one hit records. You know, I mean, this boy's a real pop star, really successful musician. And I therefore thought, you know, it'd be interesting to see what he's all about. And do you know what? I couldn't believe it. We were talking about issues which you wouldn't normally expect pop stars to talk about, like, for instance, the rollout of the vaccination. Should we now actually lift lockdown because we're all so safe? And should Boris put his foot on the accelerator and get us back into the free world? Issues like that, which we were talking about at depth. And funnily enough, whether or not we should ban flip-flops. And after a pretty hectic debate, I turned James's mind around, and he agrees with me. Flip-flops should be banned, because we had people calling into the show with horrendous stories of breaking their ankles on flip-flops and disjointed hips and all sorts of things. But anyway, that's for a moment or two. The point I'm trying to make here, Leslie, and as you are the rock chick writer extraordinaire, he was an extremely eloquent, intelligent, very polite, very measured young man, and not at all the image of the sort of rock star that, you know, I've grown up to love and admire, i.e. the sort of guys who trash hotel bedrooms and walk around in a haze of drug-induced sort of zombiness all the time.
Well, those dinosaurs are long out of fashion, aren't they? I think, you know, it's a myth. Yes, it's a myth that boys join bands because they're too stupid to do anything else. I think a lot of times these young men do form bands and they write songs because they have ideas and feelings about things that they want to express through songs, which means they can reach a very wide audience. So it doesn't surprise me at all that he was bright and intelligent and had a lot to say. On the subject of flip-flops, I mean, I've always hated them. I can't wear them because I have very slightly webbed toes, the first and second toe, with a little sort of web of skin within there that makes it just excruciatingly painful to try and walk in a flip-flop. But they are dangerous things. And I've heard one or two stories about people who get them stuck under the accelerator in their car and then they can't brake and then they crash into something else. And I mean, whether you can ban such items, I'm not really sure you can in this day and age, but any sensible person wouldn't think of wearing them.
No, I totally agree. My definition of a flip-flop was it should only be allowed in an area where there is a swimming pool or a beach. And after that, they shouldn't be allowed. I've seen in the high street, you know, in the summer, busy people milling around, and I've seen somebody step on the flip-flop of the person in front of them, because of course they don't stick to your feet. Your foot rises out of them every time you take a pace. That's why they make a flapping noise, right? And I've seen somebody step on the flip-flop of the person in front, who then has literally gone pitched head forward onto the pavement. They're ridiculous items of footwear, and they should be banned because they, you know, we were amazed, actually. James, I'm talking about McVeigh, he couldn't believe it. And he said to me afterwards, you know, I had no idea. He said, I thought that was a joke debate we were having. And I said, no, I've known about the dangers of them for years. But anyway, there we are. He also comes from Chester, my hometown. We didn't know that we both came from there. So it was, you know, an exhilarating new introduction to somebody in life. Now, what do we think about this Euro Super League, Miss Jones? Your club, of course, is Spurs. Through the fact that your uncle Cliff Jones served the North London club so magnificently. Spurs named as one of the big six who are going to break away and form this fantastic new European Super League, except for one thing, no promotion or relegation, and all the rest of the Premier League were excluded from gaining the £300 million a year each of the big six would have got. It was a plan doomed from the start, I thought.
Well, it was horrifying, wasn't it? Nobody could believe horrifying. It. Football is traditionally the working man's pursuit, his yes. reward for a hard week's work. You know, and there's that image of all the men from the factory trudging up the hill to the game on a Saturday afternoon. And it was when football became all about money yep. that the writing was on the wall. This was always coming. And well, they've backed down, of course, now. But the fans won't forget this. Because football is primarily about loyalty. Yep. I feel that the clubs themselves are not at fault. The players and the managers didn't even know about it, as we know. Yep. But the greed of these owners and their complete disregard for the loyalty of fans. Something has broken yep. now. It's a bit, I likened it to when a husband has an affair. And then the couple decide to stay together. But something yes. has changed. The yes. trust has gone out of it and things can never be the same again. And yes. that's how I feel about this.
Yeah, no, it's a very good way of describing it. You know, the family who own Manchester United, the Glaziers, who've always been hated by the fans because they bought it with a huge loan, which they then dumped onto the club. And so all the interest payments are paid through the revenues of the club. Do you see what I mean? But at the same time, they take huge dividends from the profits of the club. It's a really weird financial arrangement and it's irked United fans for years. But Joel Glazier said, now we will start to rebuild the trust between the fans and us. And of course, everybody replied and said, there never has been any trust between the fans and you. So, you know, do a runner. The one guy who comes out so badly out of all this is Daniel Levy, the chairman of Spurs. I mean, Daniel Levy has been a walking disaster for Spurs for 20 years. Spurs haven't won a league title since your uncle, Cliff Jones, was in the double winning team in 1961. Think of that. I mean, you know, you still see your uncle. He's still fit for his age, but he's over 80, isn't he?
Yeah, he's not playing for the first team, put it that way. But,
exactly.
You know, it's I just think it's shameful, the whole thing. And really, I think something has been flagged up now. Something has turned.
Yep.
Didn't Mrs. Thatcher use the phrase, the worm has turned, or yes. something like that? Or the, followed up with, the lady is not for turning.
That's right. She said, turn if you wish.
Fans, yeah, that's it.
Yeah,
the fans are ready to turn,
yes.
I think.
Oh, yeah.
And football does need to get back to grassroots. And maybe this was always coming.
Yeah, maybe. I'm very proud of my club. Everton were the first of the remaining 14 to put out a statement which said, in no way would we ever have been associated with this. It's disgraceful what these six clubs have done. You know, they're ruining the fabric of English football. As far as we're concerned, we have a commitment and a devotion, not only to our fans, but to our community and to society as a whole. And that just summed up for me. I'd already put out a tweet the following day saying, if my club Everton had got involved in this, I'd have thrown my season ticket back at them and turned my back on the club forever. And I would have done, honestly. I thought it was disgraceful. The guy who comes out of it ever so well, as Leanne, is Gary Neville. I mean, the news broke on Sunday afternoon. He was on air, right? And he didn't even say, I'll have to have a look at this or I'll have to think about this. He immediately hit out when he saw, you know, the details of what was going on and laid into his own club, Manchester United, the most famous football club in the world. He served them admirably. I think he won about seven Premier League titles with them. And and turned on them and said, it's a disgrace. My club's a disgrace. Jamie Carragher was sitting there, Jamie Carragher of Liverpool. He had to pile in then and call Liverpool a disgrace. And it was that instant attack on the whole system which triggered Boris Johnson, the Prime Minister, to get involved. And the Daily Telegraph the following day, leading on Boris Johnson says scrap Euro Super League. It was an amazing momentum that built up.
It really was. But I think we need to be very careful here and not blame the clubs because they didn't know about it. You know, it's very easy to sit here and go, oh, Manchester United, they're disgraceful. Yeah. Players, managers didn't know about it. It's the owners of the clubs we have to blame here.
Yeah,
and it does seem now, seems now that the whole thing has collapsed.
It has
but
completely
still
collapsed.
Something is broken. Something has changed. And the fans will not forgive this.
Yeah, but it's very hard to draw a line between the club and the owners. The owners are the club. This is the great problem these days. You know that the three protagonists, main protagonists, Liverpool, Manchester United, Arsenal, all owned by men in America who never come to the club and who raised $3 billion from PJ Morgan. Anyway, that's football.
The thing I don't get, the thing about football, but how come these clubs have got such huge debts? I was talking to Andy Peebles about this during the week.
Yes.
He called me, as did many other people, to say, my God, what would your father say about this?
Right.
And we were having a chat and he said, the thing is, obviously the football clubs have been closed throughout the pandemic and the main losses they've sustained has been lack of merchandise sales because they make such a huge percentage of their income from sales of shirts and other merchandise through their shops and online. So all of that income has fallen away and also ticket sales, of course.
Yeah.
So they have built up these enormous losses. Yeah. And I suppose this was a drive to try and recoup all that money.
Yes, it was part of that. That's true. You're going to remember that 90% of the money to any football club now comes through TV rights. So they didn't lose the TV rights during pandemic. If anything, that money went up because more people were watching TV. Ticket sales, yes, they lost, but that's only a small percentage. Merchandise didn't. It wasn't really hit because so much of that is now bought online, you know. And again, that went okay. But the main problem is ego and greed. And ego is because Florian Perez, the presidente of Real Madrid Football Club, just wants them to be the best club in the world all the time. So for ego reasons, he demands that his coach buys the best players. And if you buy the best players, you've got to pay him the best money because the super agents in this world take 25% of all their players' money. So they push for more and more wages. Some of the top players in the world are now paid £1 million a week. And that is to answer the question you posed, why are these clubs in so much debt? Because they simply can't sustain the massive wage bill that they have to pay to keep themselves better than their huge rivals. And it's, you know, it's a problem that's only going to get worse. Anyway, to move on, Ms. Jones, I have to say that I was saddened to hear that a guy called, what's his name, Barry Mason has died. And if you don't know who Barry Mason is, let me give you a clue.
My
Delilah.
He's actually a good friend of mine, Barry Mason, and I'm very sad. Yes, I've known him for quite a long time.
Yeah.
Barry had a wonderful self-deprecating humour.
Yeah.
He'd been ill for quite a long time, by the way, and his death was a blessing when it came. Yeah. He wrote in the good old days a good deal with Les Reed, who also died a few years ago. But people may not know his name. They will certainly know the songs.
Oh, yeah.
The Last Waltz by Engelbert Humperdinck. Remember that?
Really? I thought that was a classic from the 30s or something.
Nope. Barry Mason wrote that. Love Grows Where My Rosemary Goes, Edison Lighthouse.
Yeah, that is one of the records of my teen youth. I must have been about 13 or 14. I think I'd probably just fallen in love with my first girl at the Queen's School, Chester, you know. And I remember, and my love grows where my rosemary goes, and nobody knows but me. I'm a lucky fella, and I want to tell her. That's the one, isn't it?
That is indeed the one. Barry gave a brilliant little act. You know, the last time I saw him do this was at Gary Osborne's 70th birthday party. Gary Osborne is a lyricist who's worked with Elton John and all kinds of other people. And various people like Mike Batt and so on got up and did a little turn at this birthday party in a pub in North London. And Barry would say how important the arrangement of a song is. Every bit as important as the lyrics or the melody. And to illustrate his point, he sang a line from the chorus of Delilah. So, you know, you can sing it. Why, Delilah? Go ahead.
Why? Yeah, okay, I've got it. Yeah. Why, Delilah?
People always sing the arrangement part. The arrangement is just as important. So the other example he gave that day, Sweet Caroline. So sing me the chorus of Sweet Caroline.
This is Neil Diamond you're talking about.
Indeed.
Sweet Caroline. Da, da,
da, da, da. Yeah. You see, yeah. People yeah, always sing the instrumental arrangement.
Yeah,
and he made a very good point about how the public generally don't know who song arrangers are. But he was able to illustrate that perfectly by giving us those couple of songs. He had a great self-deprecating humour. Somebody walked into a gents in a pub one day when he was in there singing the chorus of Delilah.
Yes.
And the guy, he turned around to the guy and said, oh, I wrote that song. And the guy goes, I wasn't whistling the lyrics. In other words,
I see, yeah.
In other words, you know, it's a, yeah. But no, a lovely guy, a great
Did he write the music and the words then for his songs?
He was a lyricist actually, primarily, although he was involved in the writing of, God, I think about 10 or 11,000 songs.
11,000, it says here. Yeah. Does he write 11,000? Spandau Ballet guitarist Gary Kemp led tribute to the Lancashire Boar Mason. Shocked to hear my friend and lovely human Barry Mason died. Great songwriter who won 5 Ivor Novello Awards. Wow, that's quite amazing. Now, Ms. Jones, have you ever had to change your mobile phone number?
No, I've had the same one for donkey's years.
Yeah,
and, I think I've never changed it, actually.
Yeah, I think I last changed it about 25 years ago. And 25 years ago, your phone literally was just to make phone calls and receive them. And very few other people ever rang you or anything like that. And then I think, you know, I must have left newspapers and gone into radio or something, probably handed back my phone to the newspaper, got myself an independent phone for the first time, and I've had the same number ever since. But the reason I ask is because Boris Johnson's been advised by security people within his, you know, sort of network of protectors and all that kind of stuff, you've got to change your phone number, because too many people have got it. And funny enough, Andrew Pearce, the esteemed Daily Mail journalist, you know, who appears on GMB most mornings, said on the telly this morning, he said, well, I've still got Boris's phone number. And Boris is the Prime Minister. So can you imagine Andrew Pearce having a few sherbets? Not I'm suggesting that Andrew gets intoxicated. And ringing up Boris and saying, hi, Boris, how are you doing? I mean, it's a bizarre situation, isn't it?
I sort of feel that nobody should have the Prime Minister's personal mobile number.
Yeah.
You know, that should be a protected thing, because that is a security risk.
A huge security risk. But it's all come about because it's been revealed over the last few days that James Dyson, the billionaire businessman, has been ringing Boris and texting him to his private phone number, which he's had for years.
Yeah, no, I think there's something needs to be done about this. The Prime Minister ought to be impenetrable.
Yeah.
Can you imagine Margaret Thatcher putting herself in such a vulnerable position?
Exactly.
If anything, the Prime Minister ought not to have a mobile phone.
Yeah.
I know his partner's got to get hold of him,
totally
his
agree.
Kids and all that kind of thing, but there should be another way. There should be some sort of filter. Everybody's too accessible nowadays.
That
poses a security risk to the whole country.
I totally agree with you. The problem is, if I changed my phone number now, if I lost my phone even, I'd be terrified. But if I had to change the number now, how many people would I have to tell I've changed the number? You know, people from a couple of years back who I worked with in radio, particularly through the pandemic. Now you haven't seen people for 12 months. If they couldn't get hold of you, it would be a disaster. I tell you whose phone number I had. It's very interesting. When I was following Bill Clinton around on the campaign trail, okay, he had no chance of winning the US election. You know, Bush Senior had done so well in the first Gulf War and popularity was massively high. Nobody gave this guy called Clinton from Arkansas, the governor of Arkansas, the poorest state in the Union, by the way, nobody gave him a chance of getting anywhere. So I went down to Arkansas to find out what this guy was all about, went to Little Rock, the capital of Arkansas, and actually met Clinton and his people. I had Bill Clinton's cell phone number, as they call it in America, until the day before he won the US presidential election. And then he just went completely dead. And of course, I've never been in touch with him since.
Yeah, well, that's quite right. That's how it should work.
Exactly.
And I think, yeah, I did lose my phone once some years ago, maybe about 15 years ago or so.
Yeah.
And at first I really panicked because I didn't have a backup of all my contacts anywhere.
Yeah.
You know, I just didn't have one.
Yeah.
And to begin with, I was just stricken with all kinds of, oh my God, my life is going to collapse. It's all going to go horribly wrong.
Yeah.
And after a couple of days, I saw the positive side of that, which is, oh, okay, so not very many people can get hold of me. I can start again.
Yeah.
I have offloaded a whole load of contacts that were clogging up my phone that really I don't need to be in touch with in the first place.
Yes.
And it felt quite liberating.
Yes.
So I think you can always turn these things around.
Yeah. I reckon in a normal course of a day or a week, probably only about 6 or 8 numbers on my phone are really necessary for me, to be honest. You know what I mean? You know, people that I call regularly, you know, people I call at work, people like yourself, you know, close colleagues and friends. No, probably about a dozen, I would say. And the rest, you're quite right. I mean, there's half the phone numbers in my phone now. I can't even remember who they are. You know, I've worked in the past and all that kind of stuff. Right. OK, folks, you are listening to Life on Planet Porky. Thank you very much indeed for joining us today. Myself, the Portmeister, and of course, Ms. Leslie Ann Jones. And Leslie Ann, perhaps it's an appropriate time to say a big thanks to all the people who've been getting in touch with us lately about the old podcast. You know, lots of I do take great joy and pleasure from people who, you know, listen to the podcast and then immediately throw something out there and tell us something good or something bad or something interesting.
It's the lifeblood, isn't it? It's this communication, especially over the past year, when we haven't been able to have any sort of real face-to-face contact with people outside of home.
Yeah.
It's wonderful that people take the time and the trouble to contact us and to tell us what they think, even if they're not very impressed.
Yeah.
There was a guy during the week you probably saw who says he's bored with us because we agree with each other all the time and we don't fight enough.
Really?
So I was thinking, how can Mike and I fight a bit more?
Yeah, start doing a bit of fighting,
That has all kinds of other connotations, doesn't it?
Yes.
I mean, if we just happen to agree spontaneously about the subjects we're discussing, that shows we're on the same page.
Oh,
and every now and again, we don't feel the same about something.
Yeah, definitely.
But you can't engineer that, I feel.
Oh, no, of course you can't engineer. You've got to be true to yourself. The worst, you can, in the world of broadcasting that we're, or communications that we're both in, you can spot somebody who's not being sincere about what they feel, bang, just like that. I was talking to somebody from a TV station the other day, gave me a call, talking about things. And, you know, one thing they said to me was, thanks very much, Mike, because I get called all the time by people who say, oh, hi, Mike, you know, I wonder if you could come on our show at so-and-so. I said, what's the subject? And then they tell me the subject. And then I, before I have another word of conversation with them, I tell them exactly what my view is on that subject. You see what I mean? And for that reason, I have to turn down more pieces that I do, you know, on radio and TV than I actually accept, because I have to give them my straightforward point of view. And that's not what they're looking for. So I say, look, I can't help you on that one because this is the way I feel. Please go and find somebody else who thinks the way of the argument you're looking for. You have to be honest to yourself.
Yes, you do. And morality is a very big component here.
Yeah.
I know a lot of people, so do you, who would just take the money and run. You know, oh, what do you want me to say? What do you want my view to be on this subject?
That is shocking. I know
yes,
what you mean.
Really,
and I know people who do it, not naming names, obviously, and I'm not trying to decry anybody else in our business, but you know, some people are able to see different points of view on a subject, and I can accept that, but I can't. I have to have one solid view. Now, I tell you, I've been watching just this morning, Ms. Jones, Mick Fleetwood, right? And Mick Fleetwood was on a screen from Hawaii, where he now lives. I didn't realise that. He lives on Hawaii. But he looked in such good shape. I couldn't believe it. He was well tanned. He's like a silver fox now. He's got a bald pate. He's got silver hair down the sides of his head and lovely silver beard. And I thought, crikey, for the life that you've lived, right, you know, for the excesses that you've been involved in and all the multiple affairs and the drugs and the rock and roll lifestyle, he looked incredibly good.
Yeah, he does, doesn't he? I think he saved himself just in time. I mean, all those excesses of the late 60s and throughout the 70s.
Yeah.
There comes a point to give up, and he obviously realised that point before he was too late. But I mean, Fleetwood Mac were the greatest hedonists of rock and roll, weren't they?
Living
the dream and the nightmare.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And the reason he was on is that they're doing a concert to celebrate Peter Green. And, you know, he listed the people who are going to be involved, not just from their era, but also like, you know, Liam Gallagher, or I think it's Noel Gallagher, the guitarist. But also he mentioned another name. He said Bill Wyman. God, blimey. I thought, hang on, Bill Wyman's too old to stand on a stage now, isn't he?
He's got a little lineup. I think it's called Bill Wyman's All-Stars or something like that, which is a bit of a supergroup of kind of well-known session players. And obviously they won't have been out on the road for a while, but he still goes. I have my issues with Bill Wyman, as you know, for other reasons. Mm. Probably best not go into them here.
No, exactly. But anyway, look, you know, the other reason is that Dreams, the Fleetwood Mac song, is the third biggest downloaded song over the last 12 months of lockdown. I'm surprised it's not the first. I'd like to know what the first and one and two are. But anyway, there we are.
It fascinates me that my youngest daughter is so mad about Fleetwood Mac, and especially about that song.
Really?
And that's music that's never dated. I didn't introduce the kids to those songs, particularly. They found them themselves.
Absolutely amazing. Now, Ms. Jones, let's get serious about health for a minute, please. Men aged 40 and over will be the focus of a new NHS diabetes campaign. I'm surprised that it's taken the world so long to get onto this. As you know, I have type 2 diabetes, but I take every effort I can to control it, and it is really under control in my case, and I have a responsibility to myself to do that, but also to the National Health Service. Okay, I can't believe that people don't understand the dangers of diabetes, and I can't believe that people don't do more to try and ignore it. But without a shadow of a doubt, our indulgent society of drink, which of course I'm all for, but fatty foods, sugary foods, cans of fizzy drink and all that, it's no wonder there's a diabetes epidemic in this world.
Well, that's true. But I mean, strip it back a bit. It's because men don't go to the doctors when something's wrong. Men fear the GP. There are no routine health checks for men over 50, even. Yeah. You've got to have some particular worry to take yourself off to the GP in the first place.
Yes.
I'm wondering what happened to those well men and well women checks that the GPs used to do. Because I think I got called for one at one point, and I thought, oh, well, this is it. You know, this is going to be my thing for every 10 years until I fall off the planet.
Right.
But then I never got another one. So I think maybe they abolished that idea.
I mean, maybe because face-to-face, you know, consultations between doctor and patient have like all been scrapped, haven't they?
I had lunch on Sunday with some friends of mine, both of whom are doctors. Oh. And the husband is a GP with his own practice.
Oh.
And he said, we were talking about something or other, and he said, you should go and see your GP about that. And I said, but you can't see your GP at the moment. He said, why not? I'm seeing patients. I've seen patients all the way through.
Yeah.
So I think it applies to the individual practice and whether or not they're prepared to let patients in. But I've not been inside my GP surgery for over a year.
No, and me as well. Talking about health, by the way, and this is a real downer now, but, you know, we don't like to shirk the difficult subjects. Trevor Phillips, for whom I have an enormous amount of respect, broadcaster and journalist and, you know, sort of politician, his daughter's died of anorexia after a 22-year battle against it. What kind of a nightmare must that have been for that poor girl's parents, Trevor Phillips and his wife, over the years?
Just awful, because really there's nothing they could have done. I'm not sure they did everything they could.
Absolutely.
She looked such a lovely girl as well, didn't she?
Yes.
Somebody falls into the psychological grip of that kind of illness, and it is an illness. It's not, I think a lot of people tend to dismiss it as self-inflicted. Oh, you know, you just got to give them a good meal and they'll be fine.
Yeah.
It's not like that. It's a very complex psychological well that they fall into, that they are incapable of dragging themselves out of. Mm. And even with all the specialist help that that poor girl would have got,
yes.
She's tragically lost the fight.
I know, it's absolutely terrible. Just to brighten things up a little bit, we talked about the European Super League. Gary Neville, I think, was responsible for bringing it down. That led to a conversation I had with Jeremy Vine, right, who's a big music fan, who told me that David Bowie saved Radio 6, that when the BBC were going to try and close down Radio 6 and they announced the plan and all that, David Bowie apparently not only stepped in, he went down to Broadcasting House and remonstrated about it, and they changed their mind.
That's a lovely story, but it's not quite the case. This was in 2010, a very high-profile campaign to save BBC Six Music.
Right.
The campaign was joined by people like David Bowie, Lily Allen, Damon Albarn, and much of the UK music industry. But it wasn't single-handedly closed down by David Bowie. That is a gross exaggeration.
Yeah, you said closed down, saved, you mean? Wasn't
well, no, the, I mean the campaign to close it. So I think, you know, it's quite right that they objected. Closure would have removed a key outlet for musicians, and it would have weakened the BBC's ability to fulfil its charter as well. So it was a very good thing that they objected. But no, David Bowie single-handedly was not responsible. Sorry about that.
Oh, well, never mind. Sound like a good story, but there we are. Did you join
never
the
let the truth get in the way of a good story?
Well, absolutely. I mean, you know, it's one of the mantras we've worked with all our life. During your distinguished career, Miss Jones, I know it's mostly rock stars and all that, but did you ever, on your travels through Hollywood and LA and all that, did you ever come across Jack Nicholson?
I never met Jack Nicholson.
No, he's 84. That's why.
I would have said he was older.
Yeah, I would have personally, but 84. I didn't realise he'd won 3 Oscars and been nominated for 7. I always thought he was just a sort of a bit of a knockabout, you know, one of the lads type actors. And he always, whenever he came to this country, he always hired about 6 young girls to accompany him everywhere in a big sort of Rolls Royce, didn't he? That was the sort of image he liked to portray.
Which is very sleazy. I mean, imagine trying to get away with that now. But I tell you who else used to do that was Julio Iglesias.
Yes.
I was on the road with him in Spain years ago. I accompanied him because I was doing an interview with him.
Oh, brilliant.
I was traveling in the back of his limo. He was in the front and he had a driver.
Right.
And I was allowed to talk to him about anything and everything. But I wasn't allowed to record him. And I wasn't allowed to take notes.
Right.
So, you know, the usual reporter's notebook in your handbag and a pen tucked down your front. And whenever I sort of made an excuse to run off to the ladies, I could rush in and write down everything I could remember.
Absolutely.
But of course, that's not entirely accurate. It's not verbatim. You can't remember everything someone says.
Yeah.
I always thought it was a bit odd. But he also used to hire young ladies to hang around outside his dressing room, outside the door, sort of screaming and clamouring for him to make him look virile.
Yeah, no, I mean, the Jack Nicholson thing, you say it was a bit sleazy and all that. I don't think he was, you know, going after underage girls or anything like that. He just liked to portray himself as the party boy, you know what I mean? So every minute my life's a party, there's always young ladies hanging on to my arm and all that kind of stuff. It's an image he built. And to be honest, I've seen some of his films. I don't think he's a great actor. But he just, you know, I don't know, he just kind of rang true for Hollywood, didn't he, really, I suppose.
What was that film he did where he was an author, he played an author? I think Helen Hunt was in it as well.
No, I don't know. To be honest, none of his films have ever made an impression on me. That's the Best There Is, I think, is the title of one of them, or is that or something like
as
that.
As Good As It Gets.
As Good As It Gets, that's it. Yeah,
that's the best there is.
Well,
it's a fair interpretation.
Yeah, it's the same sort of thing. That was in the 80s when I was in America, or the early 90s, or something like that. So I'm not sure it ever, you know, he never really registered with me. Now, Ms. Jones, I have to tell you about a matter of national shame on my behalf, okay? You know what a big fan I am of ABBA, always have been, and you and I have talked about it many times. I didn't realise until Bjorn was talking this week, Bjorn Ulvaeus I'm talking about, of course, of ABBA, that when they won the Eurovision Song Contest in Brighton in whenever it was, 1974, was it, I think, or something like that, did you know that the UK gave them null points? Like, we gave them no points. And apparently, Bjorn has held this as a grudge against this country ever since.
Well, I think he's made quite a lot of money out of this country. All his musicals have been launched here, and maybe that's why. Maybe he's been paying us back all this time. But no, I didn't know that. I think, you know what, though? Get over it, move on, write another musical. It doesn't really matter. It's such a long time ago.
No, but I'm ashamed because, you know, we so embraced ABBA and I so love ABBA. I can't believe that we tried to finish them off right at the start. He reckons, you see, the British entry that year was Olivia Newton-John, OK? And he reckons that was the start of tactical voting, and that whenever we complain now about tactical voting, about, you know, Eastern Bloc countries ganging up against the UK, he said, well, you started it. You tactically voted against us to try and get Olivia Newton-John the top prize, and you failed. I didn't know that conspiracy had gone on all those years ago.
Well, no, I didn't either. But also, Olivia Newton-John is Australian. Yeah, so was that the beginning of Australia in the Eurovision Song Contest?
It might have been.
That I do not understand. No, Australia is a long way away. It's certainly not in Europe.
Sure, but she was representing this country. So if you see what I mean, you know, she was like a hired hand, so to speak.
Well, it's a little bit tenuous link, isn't it?
Talking about pop stars and all they're about, have you ever got Morrissey? Because Morrissey, the guy from The Smiths, is complaining now that he's been portrayed as a fat, whinging, moaning slob in an episode of The Simpsons, you know, the cartoon thing in America. I've never got Morrissey. I've never understood him. I've very rarely seen him. But he's a kind of manic depressive on stage, isn't he?
Yeah, but I suppose you were out of time. You were too old to really get him, weren't you? The thing about Moz, he embodied a more sensitive form of masculinity.
Yeah.
And he mattered greatly to bewildered young men of his era.
Yeah.
He was bleak. He was miserable. He came from the wrong side of the tracks.
Really?
And he gave them somebody to identify with.
Yeah.
And the Smiths were huge in their day.
Really?
He was the single biggest cultural influence on their lives.
Golly, what year was this then?
Oh God! Back in the sort of early 80s, I suppose they were massive, yeah. But I think his persona, the way he projects himself, has become increasingly toxic over the years, and he now seems very bitter and twisted and not relevant. And this is what happens when pop stars grow up; they're not relevant anymore.
Yeah, I see what you mean. Yeah, nobody's looking at me anymore. Listen, we've got to go to a serious subject again because this really does concern me. A student aged 19 at university in Gloucester, initiation ceremony, drank himself to death. Mates as usual, put him to bed after he had an awful lot to drink, you know, thought he was okay. And they go there the next morning and his lips are blue and the poor child has died overnight. That, again, must be a parent's nightmare.
Of course it is, yeah. I think the problem is not all kids are mature enough or ready for university. They've been mollycoddled in a lot of cases. They haven't grown up. At 18, lots of kids these days are still kids.
Yeah.
And they're not ready for the challenges of and the freedom, the liberation of being away from home, and they can do whatever they want.
Mm-hmm.
And these things do happen and they go horribly wrong.
Yeah.
My son told me a few stories about, and he was at Arts Ed, which is a performing arts school in West London. Initiation ceremonies were the order of the day. Every year, Freshers Week is always such a big thing when, you know, the new first years literally get initiated into the ways and whys of the university.
Yes.
And it's not only drinking games, there are all kinds of other things as well.
Well,
so this is a tragedy, but it's, I must sadly to say, it's not uncommon.
A post-mortem examination found that this is a lad called Sam Potter, had a blood alcohol reading of 362 per 100 millimetres. I think the legal limit for driving is 80, so that's 3.848, four times the drink drive limit. At the age of 19, you're just giving yourself alcoholic poisoning. And, you know, I wish people would just guard against it. Alistair Campbell, who is a great mate of mine, a great Fleet Street mate, him and his... Now, she's not his wife now. She's his... They had a civil partnership, OK? He and Fiona Miller. And I worked with them both in Fleet Street for, oh, I don't know, all the time I was there, about 12 years or something like that. Alistair is a very bright guy. He went to Cambridge. And Alistair used to tell me about the drinking games that he and a group of students at Cambridge would have against the Americans. And they would sit at a table in the refectory and somebody would bring the drinks and they would just stare at each other like they were a couple of pugilists, you know what I mean? And sink a big drink. And then the guy opposite had to sink the drink. And then Alice had to sink a drink. And then the guy opposite, until they fell off their chairs. As a consequence, Alistair ended up an alcoholic.
Yeah, it's alcohol. It's... I don't know. It's a lot of kids haven't really been exposed that much to alcohol before they go off to college. And it's not having the parents leaning over your shoulder. You know, when you're living at home and you go out on a bender to a club or something and you come crawling home at gone 3 in the morning. I remember once creeping into my parents' house. bit worse for wear, and we had very creaky stairs. Right. So I decided to get undressed in the hall downstairs.
Yeah.
And then, so I wouldn't make a noise when I crept up to my room, which was quite near to my parents' room. And so I am standing there in the hall, just in my knickers.
But it also meant you could jump into bed very quickly and pretend you're asleep.
I'd been there for hours, yeah. But of course, my dad heard me moving around. He came down to find me standing practically stalkers in the hall, trying to creep up the stairs unnoticed. And then the shrieking would start because I'd come in so late and I was pissed.
Yeah.
You didn't have your parents to answer for when you got to university. And this is the big problem.
Absolutely true. That is honestly.
But I think what kids need to do is not put these other kids to bed.
Yeah.
They need to walk them around and they need to get plenty of water down their necks, or they need to alert somebody on the campus. I remember my youngest saying that they had, there was this thing called the suit of shame, and a truck that used to drive around the university campus late at night. And any students found worse for wear were put in this suit of shame, which was a sort of, you know, those blankets that you get that are sort of foil blankets that they use when people are in shock and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So they would put them in one of these suits, put them in the back of the van, and if necessary, take them off to hospital.
Right.
There just needs to be more vigilance on the part of universities, I feel.
The problem is, at that age, of course, you don't realise any of that. You know, life, it goes in reverse in many ways. You know, when you're ready to have fun, you have no wisdom. When you can look back on wisdom, then you can control the fun, if you see what I mean. And that's what it's all about. But look, I'm not going to criticise anybody. I did exactly what you've just described. The minute I was off away from home, I spent the whole of my grant, because you used to get grants in those days, in the first 2 weeks, just going out on the lash every night. And as you quite rightly say, not having to worry about getting home and getting into the house and getting to bed without being spotted, you know. But still, nevertheless, tragic. You know.
But the thought of a hangover now, God, I can't remember the last time I had a hangover, but the thought of going through that now just horrifies me.
Yeah.
I just never want to be that drunk again.
Yeah. No, I totally agree with you in a way. You know, get old, of course, your resistance to it goes anyway. Right. OK, Miss Jones. Well, that's another Life on Planet Porky chapter. And thank you very much indeed for having joined me. Delighted to say that as we speak, it's looking like it's going to be a beautiful day. So I shall be walking over the North Downs and trying to find a pub garden somewhere beyond the rainbow.
Oh, well, good luck with that. You know where they weigh a pie, don't you?
Say again.
You know where they weigh a pie?
Weigh a pie? Who weighs pies?
You like pies, yeah.
I like pies.
Where do you weigh a pie?
I don't know, on a pie scale, I suppose.
No, you weigh a pie somewhere over the rainbow.
Really? You weigh a pie? I've never heard that before. Where's that come from?
Sing the lyrics. Sing the lyrics to the song, Somewhere Over the Rainbow.
Well, I don't know the lyrics to the song. All I know is, somewhere over the rainbow, I'm going to weigh a pie.
Weigh a pie. There you go.
Honestly, I didn't. You know, you wanted me.
Weigh a pie. Think about it. Yeah.
I think
it's a pie. It's all right. It's early.
Okay. Right. Okay, Miss Jones, take care. And to everybody else out there, please have a good couple of days. We'll be back with you again soon.
He wrote in the good old days a good deal with Les Reed, who also died a few years ago. But people may not know his name. They will certainly know the songs.
Oh, yeah.
The Last Waltz by Engelbert Humperdinck. Remember that?
Really? I thought that was a classic from the 30s or something.
Nope. Barry Mason wrote that. Love Grows Where My Rosemary Goes, Edison Lighthouse.
Yeah, that is one of the records of my teen youth. I must have been about 13 or 14. I think I'd probably just fallen in love with my first girl at the Queen's School, Chester, you know, and I remember, and my love grows where my rosemary goes, and nobody knows but me. I'm a lucky fella, and I wanna tell her. That's the one, isn't it?
That is indeed the one.
To be honest, I've seen some of his films. I don't think he's a great actor. But he just, you know, I don't know, he just kind of rang true for Hollywood, didn't he, really, I suppose.
What was that film he did where he was an author, he played an author?
I think
Helen Hunt was in it as well.
I don't know. To be honest, none of his films have ever made an impression on me. That's the Best There Is, I think, the title of one of them, or is that, or something like
as
that.
As Good As It Gets.
As Good As It Gets, that's it, yeah. I
that's the best there is.
Yeah, well.
It's a fair interpretation.
Yeah, it's the same sort of thing.
You can sing it. Why, Delilah? Go ahead.
Okay, I've got it. Yeah. Why, Delilah?